And our kind of grand plan here, or our view on the world, is that compute power itself is going to be the most traded commodity in the next two decades. It's going to surpass oil and every other commodity out there. Compute power is very general, everything from video rendering to AI training. But Bitcoin hash rate is, you know, a subset of that, and one that we're really excited and passionate about. And so we're building traditional financial derivatives, forwards and futures and swaps, on this new concept of compute power and hash rate as a commodity.
Hello and welcome to Bitcoin with Jake. This is a podcast all about people's personal journeys to Bitcoin. I wanted to know more about the people converging on this new form of money. Why do they see value in it? What skills enable their understanding? How is it changing their lives? If you're a founder looking for funding or an investor looking to make investments, then please reach out as I develop my network in the space. Do me a favor and chuck us a 5-star rating on whichever app you're using to listen, or a like if you're watching it somewhere. As insignificant as this may seem, they help a startup project like this hugely. Lastly, if you have any questions at all, please just reach out. The easiest place to find me is on Twitter at Jake E. S. Woodhouse. Now, I'd like to take a quick moment to talk about our sponsor. Fast Bitcoins are a Bitcoin exchange who you should definitely take a look at next time you're thinking of making a Bitcoin purchase. They're a great team, which for me is always the key to due diligence, whilst their product has a ton of features useful to every Bitcoiner. Check out my episodes with Danny Brewster, the founder CEO, and Nathan Smith, the chief compliance officer, to learn more about the people behind the brand. Thank you to Fast Bitcoins for sponsoring the show. Now, on to today's episode. Today I'm speaking with Ethan Vera. Hey, Ethan, how are you?
Hey, thanks for having me on, Jake.
My absolute pleasure. So being a Bitcoin show, I start in the same way most times, which is, how did you hear about Bitcoin and what were you up to at the time?
Yeah, so it goes back to my days in college. I was in fourth year of my last year of my bachelor's degree. And my friend and now co-founder, Eddie Wang, approached me with this business idea. And so I'd heard rumblings of Bitcoin prior to that. This is kind of late 2017, but I hadn't really dived in too deep yet. And we're sitting at a bar catching up because I hadn't seen him in a couple of years. He was deep down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And he just brings me to a bar, explains to me how a mining pool works, or at least tried to explain to me, because I did not understand a single thing that he said. So the next morning, with a bit more clarity and more coffee, we went to a breakout room in one of our school buildings, and he drew on a whiteboard, okay, here's what miners do, here's how they submit shares to a mining pool. And I'm like, hold up, I want to be a part of this. Let me in. It was a fascinating concept. And yeah, I haven't really looked back since.
Wow. And so at college, what degree were you studying at the time?
I was studying business. I was on the path to becoming a suit. Luckily, I got off that path. I did my internship at Goldman in their San Francisco group doing TMT coverage. And then after school, I went did a year in Hong Kong doing M&A. But
okay. The
concept of mining pools really blew me away. And that was really the hook into Bitcoin and the mining aspect of it.
Wow. Interesting. So you weren't necessarily doing an engineering degree. It was very much more of a business focus. And I'd be similar to you in that sense, having done a business management degree myself. And so you mentioned your co-founder's name is Eddie. Is that right?
Yeah, there's four of us. Eddie and Nick are the technical guys, and Guzman's, you know, semi-technical. So they're both engineers.
Yeah,
I'm a firm believer that if you're starting a software company, you should line up your co-founding team with majority software guys and try and minimize guys like me. You need somebody to turn, you know, keep the lights on. But really, if you're building a software product, you need software focused guys.
Yeah, people that can actually do it. Okay, well, let's keep it really simple for people out there that have no idea what a mining pool is. What problem is it that you originally came across as entrepreneurs? And, you know, people say, oh, I read the white paper and I got it straight away. And others are like, it took me like 5 attempts and I didn't realize what the hell it was until X happened. Eddie turned up, he pitches you this idea. You're like, what the fuck are you talking about? So break it down into really simple terms and take us through the journey that you guys have been on.
Right. And I'll touch on, I guess, a couple things here. First, I think when you're building a business, usually, or even a new product line, usually the easiest thing you can do is replicate what's already out there and
yeah.
You know, do it better or do it in a new market. I feel like society pushes this idea that you have to, you know, invent the next Uber, but not every business or product line needs to be that way. And often if you can get off the ground running on an existing business model, that will leave you room, you know, or capital or bandwidth to go pursue kind of blue ocean strategy. So the concept of a mining pool already existed. In 2011, the first ever mining pool came out, which was Slush Pool. The problem that was addressing was the cadence that miners would find blocks on. So miners compete over a fixed number of blocks per day, around 144 blocks per day, which was okay for the first, you know, couple of years of Bitcoin's existence because there wasn't a lot of miners competing. But as soon as a lot of people started competing, the chances that you individually hit a block by yourself quite limited, given there's only 144 per day and tens of thousands of people competing over those. And so in order to improve the cadence of hitting a block and hence getting revenue, Slush Pool was formed, which basically allowed miners to band together, form a group, and then collectively mine so that they hit more blocks and then pay out the reward based on the hash rate that they contributed to that pool. 2 years later, there was a big innovation in the mining pool space. A company called BitPenny released a new payment methodology that's known as paper share, PPS for short. This was a really big breakthrough in the mining industry because it changed the payout model of pools from you give us hash rate and we pay you out once we find the block to actually we'll pay you out for hash rate in Bitcoin based on the expected value. So you contribute hash power to us and we're going to pay you regardless if we hit a block or not.
Nice.
Over the long term, we know based on probability how many blocks we'll hit, but we'll front that as the mining pool operator.
Mm.
And so that concept really spurred our imagination back in 2017 on how far you could take this concept of hash rate and really trying to think through as a commodity, okay, can you build traditional products, derivatives, instruments based on the idea of Bitcoin compute power, you know, compute power pushed to the Bitcoin network? And that really got our wheels turning and has helped shape the ecosystem that our company offers today.
Awesome. And it brings to mind, so I spent some time in the shipping industry. So specifically, I was a dry bulk freight broker. So I was a middleman between iron ore miners, for example, and large dry bulk ships. And you'd get a situation where, and this is ancient, the idea of a pool, individual ship owners own one ship, maybe two ships, and they can only be in one physical place at one time. And there might not be any cargo that's close by that's actually reasonably economical to actually do. And so you get ship owners that pool together and they have, say, 100 ships all working under the same commercial management system. So you spread your bets, essentially, even though you get individual asset owners within that. So the concept of a pool is, you know, older than Slush Pool even, and it's just been reinvented on this new technology, which I really love looking at how that's happening, right? Bitcoin's this new thing. Like, what are all these different kind of business models that have been taken from elsewhere and reapplied to it? And so, you know, if you have any feedback on that kind of concept, do jump in. But equally, I'd love to know, how did you know Eddie in the first place? Like, where did that conversation even come from? And talk to me a bit about like pulling the team together and your early traction.
Yeah, so we had met 2 years prior. We tried to start a company together. Well, I don't even know if you can call it a company, really, as a project. We tried to create like a room booking system for our school where the current system that existed at the time was very clunky. You'd have to log into like the university portal, which everyone knows, you know, usually isn't the highest quality. Oftentimes rooms would be booked and then the people wouldn't show up. And so you go try and book a room and everything's full, but you walk around and there's empty rooms. So we wanted to create a system that was more on-demand booking. There was no plan to monetize this at first. It was really just kind of a project. And so we built out the wireframes, built out the design, took it to some people at the university, and they just shut it down. They said, no, we're redoing the system in a year. And so we didn't end up pursuing that. And then I kind of lost contact with Eddie for a little bit. I didn't know why at the time. You know, pretty much everyone at the university lost him. And it turns out, you know, he was deep in this rabbit hole. That was around the time that he started to find out about, you know, blockchain and Bitcoin and mining.
And so to me, that means that you've always had an interest in starting things from scratch. Would that be fair to say? And is that something that you've always been interested in over your lifetime?
I think my interest lies really on being a part of very strong teams and pushing forward, you know, novel products. Like, I've been a part of some very hard teams and non-management and non-founding positions before, whether that, you know, spans to like your early day jobs, like working in a restaurant or to hard sports teams or to Goldman. There's some element that I really enjoy of that. Like you're part of a high performing team, but I do really kind of drift towards building new product. And that really drives me to wake up in the morning, get motivated to work. And so at Luxor, like, we're not short on ideas. It's a matter of like prioritizing, because constantly the four of us and everyone at the Luxor team is very entrepreneurial, and we're constantly generating new ideas, new products to build in this nascent market, which is, you know, relatively greenfield.
And so in terms of the team, like, how did you decide who to bring in? Were there previous friendships that were in place, or you specifically went out and looked for certain skill sets? Like, how did you pull together the co-founding team?
Yeah, so Nick, who's our CEO and our other co-founder, he and Eddie actually met online, I think on like GitHub, which I guess you could consider like the Tinder for developers. Eddie is a front-end designer and a full-stack engineer, but Nick works on back-end, so, you know, very complimentary. Mm-hmm. Nick had just been coming out of a career. He's a lead member of technical staff at Salesforce in their artificial intelligence group. Wow. So he's an AI developer, but had been mining since 2013 and really was all bought into the ethos of Bitcoin. So we met him through that way. And then our last co-founder, Guzman, was actually on exchange at our university from Uruguay and just in love with the idea. And we kicked it off from there. And that was the four of us back in 2017. And now we're a 44-person team. So wow. Things have changed quite a bit. But, you know, we're trying to make sure that we hold a lot of the early day ethos into the organization, even as it scales.
Cool. Now, what an awesome journey. I'm loving it. Before we jump to the present day, which is my interest from that point, I just like to keep it as chronological as possible. So you got together as a team. Like, how do you even start a company? Like, you saw an initial problem, which is obviously, you know, what can we do to develop a pool? Rewind to that 2017, 2018, like pulling the team together and then actually creating something and generating revenues if possible, or maybe reaching out to investors. How did the process go?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of paths to successfully starting a company as a first-time entrepreneur. I would say the path that we took was one that I would definitely recommend. One, start a business when it's relatively low risk. We're in college, so, you know, if the project were to fail and the company didn't get off the ground, the stakes are not that high. You know, we don't have families to feed. We don't have a job that we're foregoing income from. And so it's low risk. And so any college student I talk to, instead of studying for your GMAT or, you know, trying to get an A+ in the last, you know, year of college when it doesn't matter and you already have a job lined up, I would highly recommend trying to start a company. I think it's honestly one of the best times to do so. And then the second is really try and find like a low-hanging fruit to start. You don't need to change the world on your first product and your first iteration. We identified a problem which there was no North American-based mining pools out there and no one really catering towards what was becoming a more professional institutional industry. Now, 2017, 2018 was right when Hive and Hut 8 and all these companies started going public in the US for Bitcoin mining. And they had to go then partner with an overseas company, usually without a contract, limited legal recourse. They didn't, you know, never saw the face of their partners. And we wanted to fill that void and serve as kind of this software partner for what we saw as a growing part of the market and an underrepresented offering in this space.
And so, Ethan, so just teach me for a moment here in terms of the intricacies of that kind of product concept. So you've got energy sources wherever the miner might find it. They convert that energy source into electricity. They're running ASICs and they are running the hashing algorithm to try and, you know, get Bitcoin. What is the importance of a software layer on top of that connecting perhaps two different publicly listed Bitcoin miners? Like, what's the value proposition to them? Like, who's your customer? Why does that actually provide value?
So we have a few products in that software stack now, but I'll focus on the mining pool to start. So the mining pool we offered, kind of going back to the earlier conversation around increasing the cadence and the expectations of payouts for a miner, that's really what it hit on as a fundamental value. And so a company like Hut 8 can connect to the Luxor mining pool, and we're going to pay them out a consistent amount of Bitcoin found on the Bitcoin network or found by mining pools. And the reason being is that miners often don't want to go and try and mine by themselves. They value kind of that consistent and predictable revenue stream. So that's like the fundamental basis that we hit on. But then there's all these, you know, what you could consider like bells and whistles that maybe not their primary goal, but are very important to their organization. They're being audited by, you know, a big four accounting firm. Can they connect that big four accounting firm with that provider, that mining pool provider, to get data to audit their payouts. Can they trust it? And then, you know, on the feature set, can they do all these features and controls, you know, that are really important for a professional organization like that? And so we kind of solved the problem of the bottom stack by giving them a full pay-per-share payout. But then we added all these additional features that made their life a lot easier and provided them value.
And you see that process a lot with software products where people are able to identify an initial pain point and they get in and they solve it. In some cases, they try and solve it and no one cares, right? And the startup fails. But in some cases, it does work. And then boom, there's other problems that you can solve for that initial customer as well. And that sounds very much like the process you've been down. So well done for identifying that and actually executing on it. Because as you already mentioned, like one has 100 ideas a day and it's hard at times to kind of like temper that interest, isn't it? To really focus in on what's driving value. And it's amazing. Like, why wasn't there an American pool provider before? Like, it just no one had really thought about it in that sense, or the others were too dominant. Like, teach me a bit about the competitive landscape and why that was an option.
Yeah, I think a large part of gathering market share is a mining pool. And market share really is the name of the game. It's how fast can you scale up your hash rate versus the network. Miners really enjoy working with a partner that adds value beyond kind of that fundamental, like full paper share basis. Like, you know, a good partner they can speak to on the phone, help them with other business, talk to their accountants, and so on. Back in 2017, the Bitcoin mining industry was really dominated by China. You know, estimates between 55 to 70% of physical, you know, Bitcoin ASICs were located within China. And so naturally, the Chinese mining pools dominated the scene. Back then, there was really no mining pools outside of China except for Slushpool. It was dominated by companies like Antpool, BTC.com, F2Pool, and Poolin. And really, we kind of rode a nice tailwind here, which was the Chinese mining ban in May of 2021 and the move from mining in China to North America, to the US and Canada. And so we kind of got lucky in the sense that we're in the right time, right place, and we ended up riding it up to, you know, number 7 globally now.
Wow, is that right? I don't think that getting lucky, I mean, yes, that's obviously a big part of an entrepreneur's journey. You have to have a bit of luck at some point. But if you weren't already batting in the space and you were doing it for very logical reasons and you'd had a load of traction, you happened to be there, well done. I mean, that's part of the game, right?
And so, yeah, I'm a firm, you know, on that point, I'm a firm believer there's like different types of luck. There's dumb luck, you know, buy a lottery ticket, win.
Yeah.
There's luck that you can get by just putting yourself in the right place a lot of times. So that's really like the hustler mentality. Just continue to build, put yourself in that position, and eventually one of them will be successful. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, other forms of luck, like build up a strong enough expertise that other people's luck become yours. And that type of luck is actually benefiting us a lot now. For example, we've carved out a nice niche of ASIC price data. And so there's been all these bankruptcies recently and people are turning to us to come bring us business. It was a business line we didn't even envision, but it kind of got dropped on our plates just by pushing forward an expertise in a certain domain. So yeah, I don't want to label it as like dumb luck, but I think, you know, if you put yourself in enough places.
You're batting in the right place, you know, and opportunities come out of it as a result. Yeah, so teach me about that. So a lot of mining companies have come under stress recently. Why is that the case? And for those out there that don't follow the mining market really closely, just explain to them the position that Bitcoin miners are in today. And then the idea of bankruptcies. And so it sounds like you're almost like an insolvency liquidity provider. So, you know, someone who has gone bankrupt, has all this hardware, they're trying to return money to creditors as quickly as possible to pay off their debts as part of the bankruptcy. And so they need to know how much their hardware is worth. And you guys, I assume, are stepping in and explaining what you would pay. Yeah, teach us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so to your first point there, I think quite a few things got us into the particular, you know, situation we're in today with a lot of bankrupt and distressed companies. I think fundamentally what's led us here is that there hasn't been a lot of tooling or expertise on how to transfer risk away from your mining business. When I speak to mining business, I mean physical, you know, buying land, buying machines. Mm-hmm. It's a very volatile industry because it's relying on Bitcoin mining economics, which is tied to the price of Bitcoin, mm-hmm. and energy markets, which, as we've seen in the past year, that is also quite volatile. Mm-hmm. And so your revenue and your cost structure is volatile. In 2021, I think miners really went risk on. They saw what Marathon and some of these other companies were doing, building billion-dollar businesses in a one-year time frame, and wanted to replicate that model. Where I think they went wrong is they really didn't transfer enough risk outside of their business. And I think that comes down to three main points. One is hedging energy costs. A lot of miners went unhedged on their power purchases, and then they ran into Ukraine-Russia crisis, inflation, everything else that really skyrocketed their main input for cost, whereas they should have locked in PPAs or done electricity future hedges. Second would be treasury management. I think a lot of miners were trigger happy on debt packages and built in too much debt capital into their structures, which performs really well. Like if you lever up during a bull run, you're going to make a very strong return, but it's equally as painful on the way down. And so they went too debt heavy. And then finally, the third problem, which we're working to address, is that they had no way to hedge their future revenue. And so these machines produce a certain amount of compute power, but there's no hedging tool to lock in the value of that compute power over a certain period of time. And so kind of those three in tandem really put miners in a tough spot this year and led them to bankruptcies and fire sales and everything else in between.
And so, Ethan, I have two questions there. So to finish off the first one, once a Bitcoin mining company goes bankrupt, why have you guys been brought in to value ASICs, I think you mentioned? And we'll take it from there.
We're working with the bankrupt companies, law firms, financiers in a number of ways, one of which is data. It's really important when these bankruptcies are happening for there to be an agreement on the value of the collateral at these companies. And so if company A goes bankrupt and they owe company B money as part of a financing agreement, they need to come to terms with how much that collateral is worth. There's no easy place to go and say, okay, this is how much an S19 Pro is worth. You can't log into like some centralized system to see and everyone agrees on it. And that's really what we've tried to build with our ASIC price index, is a source that people can use that scrapes multiple sources to aggregate those price points. And then you can base the value off that so that no single seller or entity is influencing that price. It's really an aggregate of a lot of components. Similar to how like a CME would do a Bitcoin price, they look at Gemini, Kraken, Base, and Binance US. We're doing that, but with ASIC markets, primary and secondary, primary being companies like Bitmain and MicroBT that manufacture the machines, but also secondary sources like the big brokers in the United States.
Yeah.
And so we're providing that data to a mixture of people involved in these bankruptcies and serving kind of as an expert witness on those ASIC prices.
Awesome. And that concept of data aggregation as a software business has, in number of other areas I can think of, been a very successful business model. The network effect is very strong. Once you become the leading person in the space for that type of data, then it kind of snowballs and feeds on itself. That's a really exciting proposition, I'm sure, as founders to have found on this journey. You didn't know that was going to come out of this. And to finish off my second question from before, so you were talking about the three main problems that Bitcoin miners have had, and the third problem is about hedging the hash power in the future. So is that where your pool product comes in? So you're able to pay them a specific yield effectively on their hardware ongoing because of running your probability calcs and the payment structure you have. Is that what you're referring to as like the kind of solution you had for the third issue they have? Or are you just talking about the liquidity on prices?
So the mining pool as part of a mining stack solves a short-term hedge, basically, where you're hedged from mining luck. And so on a short-term basis, you're going to be paid the same amount of BTC per hash. But that can change very drastically with difficulty epochs and transaction fees.
Okay.
And so it doesn't factor in changes in that. What I was referring to is long-dated contracts, 30 to 365 days. You could subscribe a value to that compute power. Yep. And so back in 2017, this was actually the concept that really excited us. We didn't have the means to go and execute on it. But after we got well-capitalized, raised our Series A and brought in more talent, that's when we started executing on this idea of how do we build traditional derivatives on hash rate. And our kind of grand plan here, or our view on the world, is that compute power itself is going to be the most traded commodity in the next two decades. It's going to surpass oil and every other commodity out there. compute power is very general, everything from video rendering to AI training. But Bitcoin hash rate is, you know, a subset of that, and one that we're really excited and passionate about. And so we're building traditional financial derivatives, forwards and futures and swaps on this new concept of compute power and hash rate as a commodity.
Wow. That is really fucking exciting. How cool. I've not talked through this opportunity before. So when I think of a derivative, I tend to simplify it. And I just think back to, you know, all those years ago, a farmer, he's not guaranteed to supply a certain amount of grain per ton per acre because of the weather. And he goes, okay, I want to hedge some of that risk. And there's then a baker on the other side is like, I need a whole load of grain a year from now. I don't know exactly what I want to pay, but wouldn't it be useful if there was something that I could like at least cover some of my future costs? And, you know, then up springs a grain forward contract and you've got two people agreeing on a price for a future delivery of a physical commodity. And that's obviously spread into this huge derivatives market that we have today. And what you're explaining is like a brand new niche to that in a sense. And computing hash power is obviously a whole new market that will, as you say, potentially be the largest in the world. Wow. And so what is it about that that really kind of gets you excited? And would it be fair to say that Bitcoin hash rate today is a very small niche of that future market, but if you can really get on top of it and develop products and make a success of it, you can then start branching off into other areas as well?
Yeah, this concept is really the main driver of me leaving Goldman. Was
okay.
I was sitting at my desk and I looked to my right and I saw my VP, and then next to him I saw the senior VP. Mm-hmm. And in my head, I'm like, well, you know, in 4 years, I'll be sitting in his seat. In 6 years, I'll be sitting in his seat, mostly working on the same stuff. You know, I'll have now people I can boss around, and I might not be formatting PowerPoints anymore, but I'm still going to be working on the same M&A sell-side deals. Mm-hmm. And I'll, you know, basically be doing the same stuff. Whereas with Luxor, I was like, hey, maybe I can be part of a journey here to create a, you know, entirely new commodity. Wow. Maybe it fails. Who knows? But at least it's worth, like, if you have that opportunity in life, it's really hard to pass on, you know, creating an entirely new commodity, really, and building the tooling around that. And so, yeah, I think Bitcoin hash rate was kind of the key to it because we're really into Bitcoin and, you know, believe in it. But we're also very excited about other forms of compute. I mean, fundamentally, it touches on a lot of the same things. Semiconductor production, utilizing stranded resources and energy usage. And producing compute power as a part of it. So I think it is very valuable to the world to further develop all forms of compute power capabilities. And Bitcoin hash rate might be the first part of compute power that has derivatives, but it certainly won't be the last. There's going to be everything from video rendering to AI training. And kind of going back to your example of the farmer there, for somebody like a data center, they have 10,000, say, NVIDIA GPUs that they just bought. They want to guarantee some level of return on that compute power because they rent it out. And so they don't know how much they're going to get from that in a year's time from now or 2 years, but with the use of derivative, they can lock in their revenue. And then vice versa, if you're a company like, say, you know, YouTube or Pixar, and you're going to data centers and using their compute power for your video rendering, you want to lock in your costs for an extended period of time. And so a natural market will form with, you know, authentic market participants complemented by hedge funds and prop traders that are trying to speculate, and, you know, a new market will be formed.
And let's not forget that even with smartphone adoption, you know, extremely high, there's still a massive amount of people in the world that aren't even online yet. So the growth in this space is extraordinary. Like, so much business is still done in an analog way, and that will change at some point. It's almost kind of mind-blowing thinking about it, isn't it? Like, oh my God, it's going to be absolutely fucking huge.
Yeah, huge and scary in some capacity. I think all of us are thinking that, you know.
What are we doing?
Exactly. What are we hoping move along here? But I think there's a lot of memes floating out there about like Bitcoin or crypto bros moving to AI. Mm-hmm. And I think that's certainly true also in the Bitcoin mining space. We saw it last cycle. When valuations are low for Bitcoin miners, they tend to start leaning in towards messaging around HPC, high performance compute, because that's where the attractive valuation multiples are. I think the companies that are successful in building a dual Bitcoin mining and HPC business will leverage the learnings that we made in Bitcoin mining and apply it to HPC. In a lot of ways, we're cutting edge compared to the traditional data center industry. Mm-hmm. On the infrastructure side, Bitcoin miners, more than any other form of compute, are really good at demand response. So they can plug in a few hundred megawatt facility in Texas, and then if power prices surge because of a winter storm, they can immediately turn off their machines and react to that. Mm-hmm. And so those types of learnings that we did as a Bitcoin mining industry, I think will eventually come to traditional data center, maybe in a little bit of a different way. But Bitcoin miners have certain levels of expertise that data center guys don't have, mm-hmm. that I think they should be focusing on, building products around.
Really cool. And so that concept of demand response, I was involved in a startup that went fucking nowhere, to be honest, but we were trying to help homeowners become part of the demand side response market in the UK. And it was like, if you could teach someone via an app to switch off the entire energy consumption of the house at certain times of day and get paid for it, imagine if you had 100,000 homes doing that at the same time. Okay, that now becomes interesting to enter the DSR market. For those people that don't understand what demand response is, how does Bitcoin mining, how does it mesh into the energy network, and why is that important from a demand response perspective?
Right. So I think the first level you look at is these electricity grids. It's a two-way stream. You have energy producers that are feeding electricity into the grid, and then you have electricity consumers that are taking from the grid. In an ideal world, demand is equal to supply, and that electricity flows straight through to consumers and gets consumed. Practically speaking, that never is the case on an elongated period, because there's times in which either the supply or the demand side of the equation change. For example, with the supply side, if you build out a largely renewable-based energy grid off sources like wind and solar, there's going to be high peaks of energy production and then concurrent falls in energy production. And so the energy being supplied to the grid is very volatile, the amount of actual energy. And then on the demand side, you have situations like extreme weather conditions, where people are either turning on their AC units or turning on their heaters, and they're going to, use a lot more electricity than they normally do. And even on an interday basis, people get home from work, throw on the football game, turn on their oven, that uses a lot of electricity, so it's going to require more. The problem that Bitcoin miners are solving is that Bitcoin mining is a flexible load, and it's a non-mission critical use of electricity. Which means that if you're operating a Bitcoin mining farm, if you turn off your machines for 10 minutes in the daytime, within 2 milliseconds notice, it's not going to cause you much harm. It's not like your electricity is being supplied to a hospital and you can't turn off the electricity of a hospital. Like, there's nothing really at stake for Bitcoin mining except for financial incentive. And so Bitcoin miners have acted as a very good flexible load across a lot of jurisdictions around the world, not just Texas, for creating this kind of idea of flexible load, where in the case that either supply falls or demand peaks, they can quickly turn off their entire operations, mm-hmm. and save the grid from having that imbalance and have, rolling blackouts like we see in a lot of parts of both America and globally.
And just to finish that thought process, the cool thing about being able to turn the load on and off is you get paid for it. So the grid themselves will actually pay out for a moment in time when you don't actually have to use those miners. Yeah, so to change direction slightly, Ethan, I'd love to understand a bit more as the more business-focused guy in your co-founding team. You've had some investment in the business. So you mentioned a Series A. You're now a team of 44 people. Teach us about your investment experience. So how was that? Did you have investors kind of battering the door down, trying to find you? Did you have moments where the company had no money and you really had to go out and find some? How's that been for you?
Since the beginning, we've tried to take an ethos of like bootstrap founder mentality. And Eddie was very pivotal in kind of shaping my views around that, where you don't need to build, a billion-dollar business in 2 years. A success story can come in many ways. And building a business of 5-10 million annual recurring revenue is a very good story and something you should be proud of. And so that was kind of our thoughts going into it, is how do we build a business that's sustainable, not on external financing? Mm-hmm. So we initially put in something like $40,000 into the business between some of the co-founders. Mm-hmm. We did some consulting work to bring in some other capital, and then we went on our way to build this company. We didn't raise our first external capital until the end of 2020. We raised a pre-seed round shortly followed by Series A, really as a way to grow a little bit faster, but again, trying not to get into the path of what many other startups do, which is consistently raise every year as a way to fund their burn. And so for us, that model was much more attractive from a sustainable, you know, business model. Not to say the other way doesn't work. I mean, that's how, you know, Amazon and Uber and Airbnb were all built today. But for us, we were very excited by the idea of building positive cash flow every month, scaling up the team through the generation of cash flow, building up business lines as part of that. Mm-hmm. And so today we've only really raised like $6.5 million total. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't been a ton of capital that we've raised, and we've always kind of been focused on cash flow and margins as a way to grow the business. How we look at investment like is really only get investors if you really need the capital to grow, mm-hmm. and make sure you're spending it wisely. Don't spend like $100,000 on a yacht party at a conference. Use that to hire like a really smart engineer that'll push the product.
That's a big red flag, isn't it? Guys, I just made a startup investment and they've spunked it on a yacht at a conference. Christ, what happened there?
Exactly. Or even scale it up, you know, we'll put our name on the stadium of like a basketball team.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And so did you find that process difficult? Like, you're obviously learning new things every day. You have a term sheet thrown at you, have a shareholders agreement you have to come to. There's a whole load of stuff that comes out of that. Was it challenging, that process, or did you enjoy it?
It was. I think the most important thing is if you are like a co-founder and an entrepreneur, surround yourself by other entrepreneurs. At least like for me, I found the most valuable mentors in life were the people that were like 1 or 2 years ahead of me. Mm-hmm. It's very valuable talking to, you know, somebody who's like 60 or 70 and has built a lot of good businesses, but like the technology's changed, the way capital raising has changed, like talking to somebody who just went through it is often the most valuable. So we set out to raise our first round in early 2020. We talked to a lot of founders, you know, how should we structure this? Safe agreement versus priced equity, all the nuances there. We went on a roadshow. We went to Boston, New York, San Francisco. Conversations were going pretty well for having been in, you know, what was kind of a bear market at the time. And then we ran into this brick wall of pandemic shutting everything down, Bitcoin price hitting 3.5K, upcoming halving, and all the VCs just went dark. I mean, a lot of them responded saying, you know, we're focusing on our portfolio companies now, but all the conversations died out. Wow. And so our team felt a bit disheartened because we had just spent, you know, a few months of time trying to raise capital when we could have been putting that time into to building and shipping product. And then so we basically put it on pause and said, okay, there's no point swimming up current right now if we don't actually need the money. I mean, money would be nice, sure, but we don't need it to survive. And so let's delay this. And then later that year in December, the opposite happened. Bitcoin price started rallying, the bull market started, and we had investors knocking down our door. And we actually had to like turn investors away because we didn't want to dilute ourselves too much.
Yeah.
And so we raised capital. We ended up turning some of those investors that had turned us down previously away.
Wow.
And, you know, the fortunes changed. I think the economy goes in that cycle. So 2021, it was very easy to raise capital. Mm-hmm. People were, you know, had too much capital to deal with. Like these funds were overcapitalized and they had to push funds into somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so they were just willing to hand out checks with limited diligence. And then those same investors, you called them in 2022, you know, last quarter, and they want nothing to do with you. And you can make the argument, hey, still the same company. In fact, we've made more product development, have more traction than before. What's changed? And for them, the hype cycle is gone. So I think for like where I'm going with this, for companies that have bootstrapped their business and are cash flow oriented, don't swim upriver in times of capital raising. Get capital when it's easy, and then focus on product building when it's not easy, and, you know, ship product.
And the cool thing about that, Ethan, as well, is that your approach was always to create a sustainable business. So you were generating cash flow that was healthy, I assume, at the time, which is a superpower. You know, the companies that go out and they raise all this money in year one, year two, year three, and then a bear market comes along and they can't raise, well, they go bankrupt. Like, adios, do you know what I mean? There's no business there. So it's a very prudent way of going. I really like that approach. And so along that way, or along that journey, you've now got a team of 44 people. How's that been? Do you enjoy managing people? Has it been an exciting process? I imagine it's also been rather difficult at times.
Yeah, a few things here. First, I've always had an inclination for working in teams. A team win is, you know, always more rewarding than a single win for me, at least. Like, I used to run like a little bit of track back in school, and then also played some team sports. And like after a track win, like you feel good for a second, but it doesn't feel as great as like winning as a team.
Yeah.
And so I've loved scaling up the organization. It's been an absolute pleasure. I think in terms of, you know, challenges over the years, we're a remote first company. And so creating a team culture and training remote and developing personal connections is always quite difficult when, you know, they're behind a screen. Mm-hmm. So that's been, you know, a challenge that we've been trying to address. But on, you know, the other edge of that is it's also easier to recruit talent, especially the pandemic opened up the global workforce and people now want to work remote. So we have, I think, over 14 different countries as part of our company. Wow. And so we're able to get, you know, top talent outside of our home base, which is Seattle, which I think is very important to drawing in talent. You know, not all 44 of those people would have moved to Seattle for this company. Mm. And yet we're, you know, able to employ them in Argentina and Brazil and Ghana and Philippines and China and Poland and other places.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, how that's changed things. You know, pre-pandemic, no one could have imagined how much business could be done purely online. And then, you know, a market changes things and off you go. Now you have remote only companies. And I'd be the same. I'd much prefer to be able to sit at home, look after my kids when I can, and jump online to generate value. And the cool thing being is you then don't have to live in expensive places if you go down that rabbit hole. One thing we haven't really talked about much, Ethan, here is how you feel about Bitcoin. So what you've explained excellently is business opportunities that are happening as a result of Bitcoin. And I personally feel that the startups being built on top of Bitcoin are using the best possible foundation they could to strive for long-term business success. But Bitcoin itself is fairly long-term, this idea of low time preference thinking and the way that it can alter your approach to day-to-day life. So how's Bitcoin actually changed you? And, you know, are you a Bitcoin maximalist? Is that, you know, a term that gets thrown around a lot? He spoke about compute power being, you know, lots of different markets and there's opportunities outside of Bitcoin. Does that conflict at all with how you think about things? And just, yeah, like, how's Bitcoin changed you over time?
Yeah. So I think from both a personal perspective and when we hire, I think it's critical that you're bringing in people to the company that believe in the ethos of Bitcoin, mm-hmm. a decentralized monetary system that's away from government control. If you're purely in mining for profits, then you will be short-term in nature. You'll ride the bull runs and then you'll exit for the bear markets because why would you stick around when there's hotter sectors? Mm. And so when we're recruiting, we want to make sure people are bought in to the idea of, you know, a decentralized financial system. And so I think that's really the only way. Like, we're coming up on year 5 here of building in the Bitcoin mining space. Mm. It's really the only way to have longevity is to believe in your mission. Mm-hmm. And to do well at it too. If it feels like work to you, you're not going to be good at it. It needs to feel like a hobby. Mm-hmm. We want to hire people that, you know, regardless if they work at Luxor or not, if they got on a treadmill at night, they'd be listening to a podcast about Bitcoin or mining. So I think it's fundamental to our entire organization. I think for me, like, what really got me into it was the idea of, like, well, I think mining really interested me, but I think that the idea that miners are basically almost like the federal bankers of a more just, set in stone, rule-based system that can't be altered by our will. Mm-hmm. So we, like, as a mining pool, we serve a lot of the same functions as the federal bank. We're issuing new, or we're part of the issuance of new Bitcoin into circulation. Mm-hmm. We're validating transactions on the network and helping protect it, but the rules are set in stone and everyone knows what they're playing with. We can't change those rules. We can only help support it as, like, you know, a responsible guardian of the network. And that's kind of how we see our business too. You know, making profit is obviously the goal of any capitalist business. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we're one of the strong pillars in the Bitcoin mining space so that when things come up like SegWit or Taproot, we're one of the responsible players. We're listening to the Bitcoin community and making sure we do the right thing by the Bitcoin community. Mm-hmm. So it is very fundamental to both my interests and our entire team's interests in the company.
And that's cool as well, because it kind of helps dictate culture in some ways. Like, you know that if you're going to interview someone, if they're not interested in Bitcoin, you find out very quickly, you know, what are your three favorite Bitcoin episodes ever from a podcast? And if they send you a load of crap, you know that they're not actually interested, or whatever kind of due diligence process you might have in place. But the fact that the rules are fixed, this kind of meritocracy is developing over time, and people are able to make decisions based on this kind of fixed set of rules. And I'd not thought about that as Bitcoin mining businesses being kind of like a federal banker. It's very interesting, isn't it? With a fixed issuance rate. So everyone knows what's coming, but it still needs to be issued by someone. And that's where a Bitcoin mining business steps in. Wow, okay, I hadn't thought about it like that. I feel like you're about to say something. Do jump in, Ethan. Go, go, go.
Well, a federal banker may not be the best term because we have such a negative connotation. So it's a non-perfect analogy, but definitely a more just system in which we're, you know, responsible for helping, you know, the blockchain security and keep the blocks turning.
And so, you know, I was struck by your comments about having spent some time with Goldman Sachs. You cannot, in my mind, think of a more peak fiat organization than Goldman. You know, the 2008-2009 crisis, however you might analyze how the cookie crumbled, but they were bankrupt and the government saved them. And that's largely because of their incredibly close ties to the government. And to many people that I've listened to talk about that time, you know, I was still at university, so I didn't really understand what the fuck was going on in the world. But people who did, you know, they see that as some of the most unjust behavior that's ever happened in terms of how the taxpayer bailed out a bunch of extremely risky players, you know, basically being completely unaccountable to their behavior. When you were working for Goldman, did you have any idea of that history of the company? And when Bitcoin kind of came into your viewpoint, I imagine it was just a complete, like, different world. As you already mentioned, you're looking to the left and you might be in that seat in a couple of years' time, and then you might be in the seat next to that a couple of years after that. And you decided, you know, fuck that, basically, I'm going in this other direction. Could you highlight some of the biggest differences in mentality between the two industries?
Yeah. I think from a personal perspective, I do subscribe to the belief where long-term you should be working on a project or a company that aligns with your ethical and moral view of the world. Mm-hmm. In the short term, as you're starting your career, you can make concessions to get yourself in a better place to capitalize on that. I see that with, like, a lot of kids coming out of school, they immediately want to go into, like, government roles or advocacy roles or whatever to change the world to their vision. But those people are usually outpaced by the people that go make a lot of money, gain a really good resume, build a really good business, and then go do it. And so I kind of was leaning into that. I was like, okay, what's the most prestigious job I can get out of school? Let me go try and get that. Let me go interview at, you know, McKinsey, Bain, BCG, JPM, Morgan Stanley, Goldman. And let me, like, get that on the resume first. So I wouldn't say I was ever, like, fully bought into, like, you know, Goldman's going to change the world for the better, and I want to be a part of this for the rest of my life. Mm. It was more so a function of, how do I put myself in a good position where I can set off my career in the right trajectory, and then long term, make sure that I'm working on projects that actually interest me and I feel good about working on. Mm. So I don't think it's necessarily wrong to go do something for a period of time. Mm. In terms of how I looked at Goldman, I mean, it's hard when you're in college and you're, you know, studying finance not to get obsessed with, you know, prestige. It's just talked about everywhere. Yeah. And it's a status symbol. So I definitely got sucked into that. I quickly realized it was kind of bullshit. And in some regards, it was helpful to my career. In other regards, like, it was probably overhyped. But I think going back, like, I wouldn't change anything. I'd still probably do it. But I think if I hadn't gone into, you know, Luxor entrepreneurship full time, I also would have been on a completely different path than I am today, and maybe equally or more successful. But I can certainly say, like, today when I wake up or go to bed at night, like, I am happy with what I do, which wasn't the case when I was at Goldman. I learned a ton, and I think those were valuable experiences, but I wasn't happy.
But that's the cool bit, right? Like, none of us are perfect, and there's no exactly right decision to make. We just happen to have gone in certain directions, and it's about, you know, what did you learn from that and how you may change direction. And that's what I find so exciting about asking people about, you know, where were they at the time when they found out about Bitcoin? What were they looking through in terms of a lens? And you can ask the same kind of five questions and you get completely different answers from all these people. What I'd like to do now before we kind of wrap it up, Ethan, is we've had a few questions from the audience. First of all, shout out to El Sultan Bitcoin for putting us in touch. What a legend. I wish him all the best with your business and helping out there. So Will Foxy's got a question. What does he think about Ravencoin?
So this is a running joke between Will and I. I think it got brought up on one podcast, and then we consistently tried to get each other to talk about it on a podcast. We used to run an Ethereum mining pool. Okay. So we were involved in the GPU mining space before it went to proof of stake. A lot of the partners that we previously worked with on the Ethereum mining side were trying to get us to come build pools, you know, as they transitioned away from proof of work. So other GPU ETH based pools. We didn't end up going with it. And I guess this goes back to your question earlier. Am I a Bitcoin maxi? Well, I certainly believe that Bitcoin will change the world. You know, will there be other cool technology out there that's either based on blockchain or not blockchain? Absolutely. And, you know, I think there are some projects out there that are centralized in nature that are still valuable to the world. You know, I still log into Zoom for this podcast or order on Amazon later today. Like, I think there's some services that will probably be centralized in a better version. But I mean, what gets me excited is a decentralized future. And that's why I work on Bitcoin.
It's interesting. There are times when I feel conflicted. Like the libertarian philosophy within Bitcoin is fairly simple in my eyes. It's like just let everyone do what the fuck they want and just fit in and around this fixed set of rules when it comes to money. And if that's the case, then you can invest in whatever you want. You can buy whatever you can want. You know, you can go and do whatever you want. And therefore, it's totally fine to be interested in different areas and follow those pursuits. I think what the maxis get upset about, and I do fall in this bracket as well, it's like a Bitcoin maxi, whatever that actually means. But it's, you know, what's proving to be the case with a lot of the wider crypto market and how much, you know, Bitcoin derivative was being sold and how much mismanagement and fraud was going on. And that kind of stuff is like really distasteful and just like, yeah, don't bother with any of that shit, guys. Just buy Bitcoin, focus on learning about that first. And that's my kind of predominant focus on it anyway.
Yeah, I think other industries are more palatable, right? Because if video rendering has a massive blow up, that's not going to have repercussions on Bitcoin mining. Whereas if Solana and FTX does, we get dragged into that. And so like the other cryptocurrencies out there have definitely detracted from Bitcoin. I mean, some are openly funding attacks on Bitcoin, like Ripple, you know, against energy usage. Others are just bringing us down because they tried to tie their story to Bitcoin and then they failed and they're bringing us down with them. So yeah, I think in terms of my interests, I'm definitely interested in all forms of compute power and energy usage and chip production. Bitcoin being the main one, but I think, you know, other forms of GPU compute power are also interested. I think, you know, definitely increasingly shied away from other forms of cryptocurrency and blockchain, given that it's kind of tied directly to Bitcoin. And in some ways, it's, you know, net negative in a lot of cases, whereas other forms of compute power, it's very, and it has fundamentally the same basis, but it's in a different industry. So it doesn't drag us down with it.
Ethan, just to kind of explain that in a little more detail. So let's say GPU mining that you mentioned in the Ethereum market, you're supporting another blockchain which supports other cryptocurrencies. Whereas if you were helping with AI rendering, you mentioned as one particular area, you're not anything to do with blockchain or cryptocurrencies. Is that the right way of thinking about it? Just so I understand.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And so, yeah, cool. Okay. Really interesting. Well, Ethan, listen, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. It's been absolutely awesome to have you on the podcast. Just as a final comment, where can people get in touch if they want to reach out?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, Ethan_Vera. And then you can find us at luxier.tech on our website.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to seeing how the business grows. Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, friends, nice work. You made it all the way to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this conversation. As I said at the start, if you have any questions, then please don't hesitate to reach out. And if you enjoyed the episode, then please rate, like, subscribe, and share. That's it for now. Enjoy the rest of your day. All the best. Jake.